Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 351 for Wednesday, the 13th of February, 2013. My name is Jim Race. I'm here in California along with Martin Darlington over in the Wales, also located in the Europe. Hi, Martin.
Hey, Jim. How you doing? Yeah, it's early morning here. It's still dark. And I don't know why I always give a comment on the weather, but it's quite nice at the moment.
Well, lucky you. And I think talking about the weather kind of personalizes the show a little bit, because right now, as I told you just before we talked on the show, that I'm hoping that we can pull this off tonight because I've got a storm on my hands.
Yeah, it's we're getting a touch of spring here now. But generally, whenever you get a storm, in fact, not so much you, but the eastern seaboard, when they get a storm, we get a sort of pathetic attempt at a storm a couple of weeks later as it drifts across the Atlantic. So, we're all connected.
Well, I'll deliver this one to you in about 2 weeks' time. Hold on for just a moment. All right. Just to get that out of the way.
Yeah, I've got nothing, as usual.
What do we got to talk about, Martin?
Well, there's been a fair bit in the news.
We will, on this episode, have Steve Brooks' Temple of Speed series continuing, and he's going to take a look at Italy and Monza, and that has become a bit of a fan favorite, hasn't it?
Oh, definitely. And Monza was the very first one that Steve sent in as a sort of taster, but he's gone into some more detail, and there's some fascinating stats and facts he's got in there, so that's really something for people to look forward to. We have got a bit of errata.
Oh, yes.
Carol Abraham's AB Cardian CRT bike is indeed an art bike. So, phew, that's that one put away.
I was actually quite impressed at how everybody out there did not write into us and correct us on those, not egregious, but slightly... Well, we left a few things out, I guess we could say, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I read this bit and it's kind of cool. I think it's a very interesting way for Silverstone to give back to the fans. And apparently they're going to be going from to the national paddock rather than the new wing. And the wing paddock was the one placed directly behind the absolutely fantastic grandstand, or not grandstands, but media center and all of that new bit that they built. But they wanted to bring all three classes back together for MotoGP into the same paddock. And so that's a little bit different thing. I've never been to Silverstone. You've been there, right?
Yeah. Well, I've done the last couple, and obviously I've been there before on a number of occasions, you know, just as a paying punter. A lot of it was due to fan access. So for people who had paddock passes, they had to get on a bus and come all the way up to the wing and then walk around and get a bus back. But it also means that Cops Corner becomes the first corner. And a lot of riders have apparently said, oh, thank goodness for that. You know, they love that first straight to corner.
I did read that they were going to give the fans that had chosen their seats the opportunity to move about if they wanted
they can change their if they wanted to be on the start finish straight, which is obviously moved now. They've got the option to change those or to have a wandering pass.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah, no, that's pretty fair. A couple of the journalists have been like, okay, better take umbrellas again, because apparently the old media center leaked quite badly. So hopefully they've re-roofed it and it won't quite be the same.
Well, perhaps the journos can choose either media center to reside in, although I doubt it, because that would create its own obstacles. Other stuff going on. Talk about this Honda Motor Company bit, because I think it's
They've basically, this was on MotoGP.com, and there was an article which Honda Motor Company Limited have outlined their future plans for motorsport in general, but obviously the bit MotoGP.com were reporting on was motorcycle racing, how to promote the sport. Most of it's sort of corporate blurb, but one thing did leap out that although the MotoGP effort is headed by Pedrosa Marquez Bradl and Bautista, they're also giving support to Hiroshi Ayama on the Avinti Blueson CRT bike. And then we look down the lower classes, You've got the Idemitsu Honda Team Asia Moto 2 team, which is the rider is Yuki Takahashi, and it's managed by Tadayuki Okada. In Moto 3, Hyuga Watanabe, who had some showed some he had a couple of wild cards last year and showed some promise. He came 10th in the Spanish CEV, which makes you think, okay, 10th, you know, it's not setting the world on fire. It's not a Marquez coming through the CEV, but he does seem promising. He's going into Moto 3. And let's face it, I mean, 2012 was the first year we had in my memory when the MotoGP class started without a Japanese rider.
True enough.
You know, and all we had last year was a couple of test riders standing in for injured prime riders. And it looks like Honda have kind of had enough and said, you know what, we're going to start pushing some of the young Japanese riders through. Okay, Ayama Takahashi ain't exactly spring chickens, but we've got Nakagami in Moto 2 and Watanabe getting HRC support, you know. And as I put it, someone's got to take on the bloody Spanish.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, last year was the first time that I can remember a test rider getting on the podium in forever for Yamaha.
Yeah.
And so perhaps that was a bit of spurring on. It'll be interesting to see. You know, there was an interesting bit. I originally saw it on David Emmett's site, Moto Matters, about how Neil Spaulding had finally managed to spot the speaking of Honda, by the way, had finally managed to spot the RC213V engine in its full naked glory. And as it turns out, it's also a 90 degree V4, which doesn't sound like a whole lot of interesting things on the surface until you realize that one of the things that's being lamented and pointed at very, very pointedly, if you will, is the Ducati 90 degree V4 as being the culprit in the troubles that Ducati has had. It's a great article and sort of a rebuttal to himself. And it kind of points out that maybe a lot of people, and certainly a lot of people, were pointing at that engine as being the problem. But the problem, as David very clearly pointed out, was not necessarily one of just the engine configuration, but also the way the engine was placed in the chassis. And so, Martin, you may not have read it yet, or I'm sure you would have put that in the show notes, but it's a fascinating read. All of the media outlets have picked up on it and are extrapolating to and backpedaling to their their best effort. So it's been a pretty kind of a bit of a wake-up call, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Spaulder's absolute talent is he's very, very technically astute and very knowledgeable, but it's his ability to put that into a way that a nugget like me can understand.
Well, if you don't own his MotoGP technology book, I'll buy it.
Which I don't.
Yeah, and so you better. Mine, unfortunately, is packed away in a box somewhere, but it's brilliant, and it's a very good. It's a primer, even if you're new, and it's a filler in if you have years of experience, like, of course, all of us do. So definitely MotoGP Technology by Neil Spaulding. You can find it pretty much anywhere, Amazon, COUK, all over the place. Definitely a worthwhile investment.
Yeah, and just thinking on the aspect about the Japanese rider thing and Honda, just pointing out there that Yamaha had a podium with a test rider. That's a good point, actually. Amongst the Japanese factories, the next one who gets a top Japanese rider, I'd imagine there's a fair amount of internal competition on that.
No doubt.
Which is an aspect we might not think about. You know, yeah, they want to have world championships, but if they could get a race winner and possibly a title contender who is Japanese on a Japanese bike, that's going to be kudos up the yin-yang, you know?
Well, I mean, if you think about how important, for example, Suzuka 8 Hours is to the Japanese factories, and most specifically Honda, you can see that there is probably a bit of inter-country rivalry, especially within MotoGP, because they haven't had a Honda rider or a Japanese rider on the MotoGP podium. I am trying to remember the last Honda Japanese rider on the podium. I'd have to go back away. And probably, sadly, that particular individual is passed. Quite some time. We're digressing and waffling again, aren't we?
As usual. I think that's what people like. We'll go into detail on the Moto 2 test at Valencia last week. But on the Thursday, the final day, Tom Luthi, the Intertoto Moto 2 rider, definite title contender, had a huge crash, which caused some concern. He was flown to a Swiss hospital and he's undergone a 5-hour operation. They've said it was very successful. He's expected to make a full recovery and have full mobility restored. But the team have not been able to give a date for when he'd be able to return to riding. So the season start could be in doubt. Hopefully not, because it is still some time away for Moto 2 and MotoGP. But he almost certainly is going to miss. Well, he's definitely going to miss this week's test at Jerez, which will be interesting, as we'll see when we go through the Valencia times.
Why don't we go ahead and do that now? Because we've got a whole bunch of test stuff to talk about.
Sure.
I don't want to keep myself too long, nor you, Martin, because both of us have things to do, and I'm still trying to retreat from a gnarly little illness. So why don't you walk through those, and I'll interject as I usually do.
Sure. It was over 3 days, and what we've done is again, Moto Matters. David Emmett has done a fantastic job of consolidating the times. So this is, based on the best times throughout the 3 days. And at the top of the trip pile, no surprises, Pol Espargaró. Mildly surprising for someone just looking in, Nico Tirol was second. But let's not forget, he always runs really well at Valencia. I mean, last season, he was nowhere all season. Then suddenly he led that last race for much of it until Marc Marquez did his back to front, Julian Simon on his Kalex, he was in third. Jordi Torres in a Suter was fourth. Tom Luthi was fifth. Of course, he's had that crash.
Torres is that's a very strong showing for him, frankly.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I don't know if he's a local boy. He is Spanish, but I don't know whereabouts Torres is from. Then we had Luthi, Nakagami, Redding, Rabat, Corsi, Johann Zarco, who made massive improvement over the 3 days, and he's now on a Suter. Agata, Axel Pons, 12th. Good lad.
Who we
mocked.
Yes, I know.
I mocked, and I feel very bad. Well, no, I feel mildly bad. No, in fact, I don't really feel bad, but
that's
why.
I know. It's like, well, wait till we get to the World Superbike results. Both of us are going to have red face. So carry on.
Yeah. Mika Kallio, Tony Elias, Javier Simeon, Ricky Cardus, Ant West, Mattia Pessini. These are all familiar names. And Cardus, West, and Pessini all on speed ups. Yep. And there's seven speed ups in the test. Corsi was ninth, was the fastest one. Rataparc Willerot was 19th on his Suter. Alex De Angelis on another speed up was 20th. Kotesi Takahashi, Stephen Odendahl on yet another speed up. Danny Kent, one of the rookies. Kyle Smith, another one in 24th, 25th. Randy Krumanak and Mike D'Amelio near the back on his Moto. Is that the Moto by Motor? Moto by, it's called.
Moto Beer.
Yeah, Moto Beer. Louis Rossi, another.
Moto Beer. I like that.
Moto Beer. Yeah. That'll do. Alberto Montoya, Donny Tata Pradita, Marcel Schrotter, and Arafid Topan Sukipto rounds out in 32. So
I was impressed with that pronunciation. Did you practice that?
No, I just said it really fast and hope no one will notice.
I'm impressed.
So this week will be interesting because we'll have obviously a change of track. Jerez, a very different type of track to Valencia, very fast flowing. Be interesting to see if Nico Tirol can maintain a position anywhere near the front. What David also did was looked at the improvement over the 3 day period. Some people stand out. And Johann Zarco improved by 2.7 seconds, which is nearly a full second more than anyone else. Rataparc Willerot was 2 seconds. Takahashi improved by 2 seconds.
One of the things that I noticed about this year, and I think it may have had some influence on on these times was a lot of the teams were very clearly, you could see from a visual standpoint, trying out a lot of new aero configurations.
Yeah.
And obviously in a key or in a series, that being Moto 2, where the engines are all theoretically the same as are the electronics for the most part. And it's the chassis and the aero, and other little tweaks and tricks that make the difference. That's one of especially the things that these guys are doing. And on top of that, we should also take into account, Martin, that all of these teams, especially the team, you know, what would have been interesting to do for this, for this comparison, would have been to have the rider weights for these.
Because of course we've now got the limit. How many of them come in below it and therefore have to add weight?
And so on top of the aero, you've also got teams moving the weight around the bike, trying to find the optimal balance. And that certainly made, I guarantee you, it made a difference in some of these guys' lap times. That'll be fun.
I wonder if we'll get that information.
I had a series of emails go back and forth between a certain team member talking about weight and what they were doing. Well, I won't mention any names. It was an interesting conversation. It didn't sound like it was too involved, but that was prior to the test. So I'll be curious to see what kind of information I can get afterwards.
No, definitely.
Yep.
We also had Moto 3 running at the same test.
And on top of that, like you said, we've got more testing coming up, not only with these same guys, but also with Sepang 2. We're in the thick of it.
Yeah, definitely. The thing I got about interesting about Moto 3 was, although Moto 2 and Moto 3 did have exclusive track time at times, at other times they were both classes were out on track at the same time. I was thinking, isn't that like the really dangerous thing when you look at closing speeds? But I guess the gap between Moto 2 and Moto 3 probably isn't as great as the gap between Moto 2 and Moto GP.
No, I wouldn't think so.
I might be wrong about that, but yeah.
Well, I mean, if you look at the so let's take the slowest guy, for example, in Moto 3, Florian Alt. He's running 1:44.672, and that was his best time over 3 days. And then you look at the slowest guy in Moto 3, Moto 2. That's a 1:42.659. That's only 2 seconds off. Let's go to the fastest guys, Paul Espargaro, 1:35.520. And then you look at the slowest guy, you're talking 9 seconds. That's a fair amount of time over a 2-minute lap. And it's not necessarily about time. It's about top speed. And so closing speed going into the corners is where the danger and difficulty usually arise. But on the other hand, the Moto 3 bikes being slightly more prototype-ish, or a lot more prototype-ish, probably are carrying just about as much speed into the corners. The trick is...
And they don't break, do they, basically? Yeah. They just try and carry it all the way through.
The trick is going to be, it's not necessarily even going into the corners so much as the terminal speeds of both classes somewhere around 50 to 100 meters before the entrance to a corner. That's where things get a little weird because everybody's trying to figure out where somebody's going to break or not break. I would say you certainly wouldn't want to have necessarily Moto 2 on the track at the same time with the big boys, maybe with some of the CRTs, but I said that, didn't I? Ooh. I think they're two more compatible classes, if you will, than say the full-on prototypes in a Moto 2 series being out. But
yeah, definitely.
And more waffles. Would you like some syrup with that?
So the Moto 3 results overall over 3 days. At the top, getting on very happily on his new KTM was Maverick Vinales. Alex Rins, Louis Salom. So three of the usual suspects. John McPhee looking fantastic on an FTR Honda. Mm-hmm. Jonas Folger on a Kalex KTM. Jack Miller on an FTR Honda. And let's not forget that McPhee and Miller are in this German team.
Yep.
Both of them being German. Oh, no, that's right, they're not. Romano Fenati was seventh on his FTR Honda. Because on the first day, it was only Fenati. Fenati's was the only Honda in the top 10.
Yeah.
Alex Marquez, the younger brother of Mark, was on his KTM, was eighth. And very interesting, we then had Vasquez and Oliveira on the Mahindras. So Mahindra have definitely done. Efren Vasquez tweeted a photo and said, looking forward to everyone talking about this name this season. And I thought, oh, and he's done a picture. And the picture was of an engine block or the side of his Moto 3 with Mahindra. So, I mean, Danny Webb must be looking at that thinking, great. I mean, he had to drag that dog of a bike round last year with just way down on speed and power. But yeah, they've obviously done some really serious work over the closed season. So good for them. And it'd be nice to see, you know, a third manufacturer up there. And then we went on down.
If you think about it, you go back. I mean, how much of that is truly a Mahindra? You go back to the Derby Gilera Aprilia days. Well, what were those bikes? They
were all Aprilias. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah. A rose by another name still smells as sweet.
Indeed.
Right, to get a bit Shakespearean. Livio Loi, 14th. Mark VDS's protege. He's on his Kalex KTM, did very well. Danny Webb on his Suter was down in 20th for the Brits. And Juan Guevara on the TSR Honda, 19th. I'm looking, Tony Finsterbusch, I was disappointed, down in 25th. Jasper Weimer, another one who's been tipped for good stuff, 26th. But, you know, first test of the season, it's early days. And as you were saying earlier, Jim, you know, they'll have been testing all sorts of stuff.
Would you like to say Finsterbusch again, just to...
Finsterbusch, yeah, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I'm going to have to get you one of his T-shirts.
Yeah, I would become an official, Tony Finsterbusch fan.
Perhaps you should start the Tony Finsterbusch fan club. Yeah.
I suspect it might have a membership of one. And actually two, me and his mum.
Yep, there you go.
Right.
All right. So in addition to that, obviously, because we know we've got coming up this forthcoming weekend, which is extremely cool, in between the last time that we did a show, and apologies for taking so long to get you another one. Well, it hasn't been so long, a couple of weeks, but we knew that we're going to be having the World Superbike and World Supersport gentlemen blow into Phillip Island, and come in they did. There was an unofficial test. I wish I'd put together the World Supersport stuff. Or should I scroll down? And is that here somewhere, Martin?
The unofficial, we didn't actually have listed times.
Okay.
But they did, there were reports that who was doing well.
Right. And the unofficial times, we'll just zip through the top of those because it is interesting. Clearly, the new tarmac at the Phillip Island circuit, much like it did for the Island Classic folks, is making a difference because the times were quick and all they did was get quicker from the unofficial. Let's just say, take your top five guys from the unofficial. Eugene Laverty, Leon Kamier, Jonathan Ray, Leon Haslam, and Marco Melandri. We should mention that there were a bunch of crashes during this unofficial test, some of which actually put some guys into some very serious pain. Tom Sykes did suffer a broken wrist, I believe.
Yeah.
Which he soldiered on with later. There were some bikes that were incredibly beat up, including a crash by Kamier, another one by Jules Clusel, I think.
Loris Baz destroyed his ZX10, yeah. ZX10. God, I'm turning American. and of course, those were day one times. Yeah. On day two, Leon Kamier, Sylvain Guintoli, Jonathan Ray, Marco Melandri, and Michel Fabrizio topped the times. And Leon Kamier actually broke the lap record, although unofficially, because it was an unofficial time.
And what this has caused me to do is about four times this week, I've already changed my MCN Fantasy League people around.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But those day two times then became, overall times for both days, top five.
Exactly.
So everyone was quicker on day two. We did get reports from World Super Sport, Sam Lowes on his Yamaha R6, Yamaha making a return to the World Super Sport paddock, and Michael van der Mark were both setting times just outside lap record pace. Very encouraging.
Certainly very impressive. And I believe as we moved on into the official test, things even swapped around a little bit more. One other thing of note is that Carlos Checa basically didn't ride in the unofficial test. He had, how can I put this?
A blocked bowel.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks. And I think I saw, I'm pretty sure it was on Moto Banzai. Just he had a bit of prunes, and it kind of cleared him out. But and certainly that did stand him well when we got into the official test times. It was
also he was visited in hospital by his teammate Ayrton Badovini, but it wasn't a social call. It's because Badovini had crashed and needed to go there. But he's okay and was back on Monday's test.
Yeah, it was a bit of a mess, to be honest.
Yeah,
and it isn't always that way, and I suspect that part of it was with the new tarmac, guys were testing the limits and found them pretty well. But yeah, there was a lot of damaged or, in some cases, destroyed machinery, and which is difficult when you're away from your home base, because we know that the rules for having complete bikes have changed a bit in the World Superbike paddock. So it certainly caused some teams to scramble, and there were probably a lot of guys that didn't get a whole lot of sleep in that paddock.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul Denning was joking that, he had some great, great lap times, and it's already cost us 50 grand in spare parts.
which if you think about it, isn't that much.
It seems a lot to me.
Yeah. Okay. The point well
done. But yeah, in relative terms, absolutely. And these guys are finding where the limit of the track of the grip on that new surface is. But it sounds good.
Yeah, it does. It does. It certainly does. And but as I mentioned, we really got a good indication of that from the Island Classic. That was nice having a little preview of what was going to be going on. And just a reminder that Phil Hall will be there for us this coming weekend to cover the opener of World Superbike and get us a whole bunch of interviews, which means next week's going to be special. And so I'm already looking forward to that. And then we had the official test, and that has been going on for the last 2 days. And due to the lovely vagaries of time zones around the world, day two of that just finished up, an hour ago. And so we have combined times from that too. And that sort of shuffled the deck. Carlos Checa, once he, cleared out his pipes, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I started to say that and I couldn't stop. Managed to end up on top. Now, I want to remind you guys that the race lap record there is a 131.785 set by Max Biaggi in 2012, which is, by any accounts or measures, a fast lap around PI. Checa's fast lap was over 7/10 faster than that at a 131.059. On top of that, we had all of the top 10 guys in the 131s, and we had the top 11, or let's cheat and say 12, all within a second of each other. What does that mean, Martin? That means we're going to have some kick-ass racing.
And as you pointed out when we were talking pre-show, the top five, in fact, the top six are all different bikes.
All different manufacturers.
Checa on a Ducati. Then we got Melange on a BMW. Kamiya on a Suzuki. Sykes on a Kawasaki, riding with a broken wrist.
Yep.
Fabrizio, the fastest Aprilia. Good for him. Because we've always been a huge fan of Michelle. Johnny Ray on on the Fireblade. And, I mean, what, 0.04 of a second behind was Leon Haslam. Whoops. On the other 10 Carter.
30.56. I lost you again.
30.56.
I'll wait.
What did you hear?
I heard You got to Johnny Ray.
Okey-doke. Okay, I'll keep going on my own timings. Okay, let me know when you're ready to come back in. I'll count you in if you want. Okay, three, two. Johnny Ray on the other Fireblade, and a fraction, 400ths of a second behind him was Leon Haslam on the other 10-carter Fireblade, or the Pater Honda Fireblade. Then Eugene Laverty, surprisingly down in eighth, but I say that, it's like, oh my God, he's 400ths of a second behind Checker, who's leading. So this is incredibly tight. On
Absolutely.
an Aprilia, then we had Davide Giuliano on the Satellite Aprilia, then Sylvain Guintoli on the other Factory Aprilia, and those guys are, two tenths between them. Georges Clouzel looking good on the other Fixie Crescent Suzuki. Chas Davis on a BMW. Glenn Allerton, Aussie, local. Don't think he's a full entry, so I think this is a wild card. On a BMW, Jamie Stauffer, another Aussie wildcard on a Fireblade. Loris Baz, Tom Sykes' teammate, in 15th on the Kawasaki. Ivan Clementi on the one of the Satellite BMW S1000s, the HTM Racing, and Vittorio Iannuzzi on the Grillini Dentalmatic. That just still makes me wince and think of someone with a mouthful of metal.
Does do.
BMW. Federico Sandi on the Perdicini Kawasaki, and his teammate Alexander Lund just behind him, Max Neukirchner, and a rather battered Ayrton Badovini bringing up the rear. So Alstare Ducati have bookended all the times. So that's 21 of them. Now, that bear in mind, we've only got 19 season-long entries, so
Well,
it is
and
going to be a light grid. Thank goodness, though, they're going for 3-bike grid this year.
Well, on top of that, if you look at it, as compared to, say, the MotoGP field, with 21 riders that should be entering into the race this coming weekend, instead of having, basically, you've got 2 seconds between the quickest and the slowest guys, and that's still going to come down. I don't see a whole lot more time. You might see guys go faster in qualifying. I'm sure you will, in Super Pole, but when it comes to race times, I think 2 seconds might be the maximum gap you're going to see between the quickest guys and the slowest guys. I looked at the long-term weather for this weekend, and it looks like it's supposed to be good, but trying to guess the weather at Phillip Island is sketchy at best. But this is a good time of year for it. When it's snowing and miserable weather in our part of the world, Martin, that it's can be quite nice down there. But it's also temperamental. So we'll have to see how it goes. I mean, if you think about it, it wasn't too long ago that we were hearing down in that part of the world about how they were modifying their temperature scale for weathercasters because they were hitting highs that they'd never seen before. So a little bit.
But Siberia Corner isn't called Siberia for no good reason. It's right on the coast. It can get very, very, but well, we literally have had, not literally, but we've had 4 seasons in one day there.
I think literally we have.
Yeah, I just try and avoid that, football commentators. And his feet were literally on fire. Like, no, they weren't. He was just running really quick. He was literally running fast.
Well, okay, you can count a fifth season with instead of cats and dogs living together or raining cats and dogs, the attack of the seagulls. I believe that counts for an additional
Yeah, I
bit.
mean, it's one of the things. I remember Troy Corser saying, once you've done 3 or 4 seasons at PI, you will definitely have had at least a near miss with a seagull.
Yeah.
And in his case, you'll have wiped out a couple.
Yeah. So certainly having some contact. Let's go ahead and run Steve's bit while we have the opportunity, right?
Absolutely.
And then we'll come back and we'll just talk a bit about the upcoming Sepang test, a little bit more about World Superbike. And then we'll see if we can't package this up. Not a super long show this week, but Trust me, we're going to make up for it next week. Next week will probably be a 3-hour monstrosity. So fair warning now. But we wanted to at least have the opportunity to talk to you before racing actually got underway. And frankly, I miss talking to you, Martin. So
absolutely. And this is sort of last week's and this week's combined. So this is for Wednesday the 13th and Wednesday the 20th.
Exactly. So it's a full week worth of
show.
Show and tell. All right. So let's roll, Steve, and we'll come back in and we'll see if we can't close this thing up.
The Temples of Speed, Episode 3, Italy. His passion for and tolerance of motorsport is legendary and ingrained in the DNA of Italian people. If they can lash an engine to a wheelbarrow, make it go faster, and of course look fabulous, then they will. They're also remarkably knowledgeable of racing and its history. Despite not being one of the founding countries of the FICM in 1904, Italy was, right from the turn of the 20th century, alive with road circuits, though these were more like time trials and modern-day car rallies than head-to-head racing. In 1904, the Coppa Florio was founded, a 116-mile dusty challenge around Brescia, followed swiftly by the Targa Florio in Sicily, which ran in various forms around three road configurations until 1977. The longest route was a staggering 652 miles. Legends made their names there: Ascari, Varzi, Nuvolari and Ferrari. This was followed by arguably the most famous road trial ever, the Mille Miglia, meaning 1,000 ancient Roman miles. Run from 1927, the first race left Brescia and crisscrossed through and around Tuscany, also taking in the legendary Futa Pass, still used to this day to prove a Ducati's tenacity on the twisties, and through Pesaro, Rome and Bologna. This shaped the careers of Stirling Moss, Rudy Caracciola, of whom the legendary Carousel Corner on the Nürburgring is named after, due to his Mercedes being the first to utilise the drainage ditch beside it to negotiate the bend. But the most famous was Clemente Biondetti, who won the Mille d'Emilia three times, making early Ferraris, particularly the Barchetta, or Barchetta, household names worldwide. He also won the Targa Florio twice in his mid to late 40s, much older than most of his competitors. He's immortalised by having a Mugello Corner named in his honour. There was also a tough circuit along the Adriatic coast, around Pescara and the surrounding mountains. These were all dusty, exhausting road trials. But all this changed when, clearly smarting from being beaten by the punch to the punch by Brooklands and Indianapolis, Italy replied in a record 110 days by utilising a workforce of 3,500 people. Monza opened for business north of Milan in 1922, with a high-speed track 3 miles long and the road circuit almost 3.5 miles. The total configuration, which shared the main straight, measured around 10 kilometres, or just over 6 miles. Set in the beautiful Royal Park at Villa Real, conservationists made many objections before it opened, and again in 1990. The Green Parade almost won their battle to demolish the crumbling bank circuit, only partially used for the Rally of Monza. Thankfully, Italian motorsport heritage won the day, and the complete track, or tracks, still coexist. In 1924, the first European Grand Prix was won by Guido Mentasti on a Moto Guzzi, covering the 250 miles at a respectable average of 81 miles an hour, something the then huge Guzzi factory still cherish an hour or two up the road on the eastern shores of Lake Como. So, when the inaugural World Championship started in 1949 with a 6-round season, Monza, along with the Circuit van Drenthe of Assen, were on the calendar. The high-speed banking was never used for GPs. Nevertheless, without the chicanes, you see now the track was initially quicker than Spa in Belgium, with Nello Pagani's Gilera winning with a fastest lap of 162 kilometres per hour, a shade over 101 miles per hour. For over 20 years, the Grand Prix of Nations, as it was then called, ran until 1971, before alternating with Imola until 1976, when competition hotted up with the introduction of the beautiful Mugello, gracing the Tuscan hills, and three became four, with the Adriatic venue of Misano appearing in 1980. Soon after, Italy ran two GPs a year, with many various titles like Grand Prix of Nations, San Marino, City of Imola, and even the Italian Grand Prix occasionally. But back to Monza. Plenty has been written by myself about this magnificent yet menacing high-speed temple. Oh, by the way, that's the track's own moniker, not mine, as the original defence of the place spawned this series of labours of love about the locations where the legends made their names. So, let's have a look at the Grand Prix history of this Italian masterpiece. The greats won numerous GPs at Monza. Duke, Surtees, Halewood, Reed, and the most prolific, at 8, Giacomo Agostini. To underline just how fast the place was before the chicanes were installed, Ago won the 1971 500 race on his MV with the fastest lap of 1 minute 41.2 seconds at 203 kilometers per hour, over 125 miles per hour. What speeds the MV was capable of 42 years ago is anyone's guess, but whilst Monza bowed out in 1987, with Wayne Garner winning, on the three chicane circuit of course, the fastest lap was almost 8 seconds slower, and at 191 kilometres or 118 mile an hour. In fact, Ago's 1 minute 41.2 hasn't yet been beaten, though Max Biaggi's MotoGP, World Superbike Aprilia, ran it close in 2011, with a qualifying lap of 1 minute 41.7 at a slightly higher top speed, due to the circuit being a bit longer with the three chicanes. Talking of top speed, in 2012, Tom Sykes Kawasaki hit an astonishing 211 miles per hour. By heck, Monza's still quick. The F1 boys could top 230 miles per hour in the V10 engine days. Now their speeds, top speeds, only match Tom's pace, though they're plenty faster around the corners, borne out by Juan Pablo Montoya getting round in 1 minute 19 seconds, or almost 163 miles per hour. Monza's fastest ever lap, if you're interested in cars, of course. However, Monza has always been tainted with tragedy, and the chicanes were introduced after the fateful meeting in 1973, when the 250 race claimed the lives of Renzo Pasolini and Jarno Saarinen, leading to the event being cancelled. In 1928, Emilio Materazzi and 27 spectators perished when he crashed into the grandstand. In 1933, another car GP was named Black Sunday when three top drivers died. In 1955, Alberto Ascari lost his life in practice at the Vialone, since renamed the Ascari Chicane. 1961, Wolfgang von Trips and 14 spectators were killed after he tangled with Jim Clark approaching the Parabolica, the same place that claimed Jochen Rindt in 1970. Rindt went on to be the sport's only ever posthumous world champion. Popular Ronnie Peterson died at the start of the F1 race in 1978, and 20 years later, James Toseland's then teammate, Michael Paquet, perished on his World Supersport Honda. Like most of the iconic temples of speed, danger is always lurking, and despite all this tragedy, competitors and fans still flock to Monza to witness the sheer noise and velocity in this most beautiful of settings. When the engines have stopped and the tifosi melt away, there is still no place like Monza for sheer atmosphere. Whether you gaze down the straight from Ascari to the Parabolica, around the Curva Grande, or gaze up at the high-speed banking as beside you the birds sing and the wind sighs. Autodromo Enzo Edino Ferrari, or Imola, named after the Maranello legends, can't match the speed of Monza. But don't discount the pretty circuit shoehorned into the far end of town. Opened in 1953, originally to serve its testing by Ferrari and Maserati, as it was nearer than Maranello or Modena, the original circuit was spawned from roads in the local Castellaccio Park. For the first two decades, there were no chicanes, and the speeds reached, whilst not at Monza levels, were still pretty rapid. As again safety became more of a concern, it was significant that Ago's fastest lap of 1972, 165 kilometres per hour, beat the last modern GP lap by 3 kilometres per hour, that being the two-stroke Honda NSR V4 of Alex Barros in 1999. Still, anyone who has visited Imola will testify that getting around a lap at over 100 miles an hour is a fair achievement. Finally, Ago's record was beaten by Tom Sykes Kawasaki, but only by a tenth of a kilometre, though the track was extensively remodelled in 1994 after one of the blackest days in modern motorsport history, when Roland Ratzenberger and Ayrton Senna lost their lives. There had always been concerns about the speed of the first part of the lap of Imola, where the cars were flat out for a mile before the left-hander at Tozer. With other Formula One stars like Piquet, Berger, Alboreto and Patrese previously surviving very high-speed crashes. In fact, veteran Rubens Barrichello was seriously injured in practice at that fateful meeting in 1994. Deteriorating facilities marked the end for Formula One in 2006, and despite being remodelled by, say it quietly, Herman Tilke, who built new pits and removed the chicane before the finish to give a flat-out blast down the straight, Imola still hasn't got the car GP back. World Superbikes didn't welcome the change and kept the chicane in, and we've already seen some key moments at this complex. Remember a wildcard Marco Simoncelli bouncing his team leader Biaggi out of the way a few years ago? The undulating, intense lap Imola produces means a fabulous experience for fans and an immense challenge to riders, though its very nature as a Parkland circuit can still mean danger, as emphasised cruelly by Juan Lascaux's testing crash in 2012. More positively, the iconic 200 miles of Imola, possibly the defining moment in the race history of Ducati, is starting to become a major historic draw for a growing revival scene here, and long may it continue. This circuit can probably challenge Monza for Italian passion and the devotion of the Tifosi, seeing the place as home ground for Ferrari, and it seems inconceivable that Imola claim 140,000 folk have squeezed in here, but it's true. Travelling down the bolt straight road through the town, you cross the river and into the circuit. The names like Tamburello, Villeneuve, Tosa, Acqua Minerale, Pirotella, Variante Alta, Rivazza and Variante Bassa leave you in no doubt of the history here. Parts of the trails through the woods remind you of Monza, maybe even the back of the GP track at Brands Hatch, as you encounter tennis courts, a nature reserve, restaurants, flats and houses scattered in and around the place. Remember, this is a living, breathing community as bikes thunder around the park. You are reminded of the danger as you arrive at the Tamburello chicane and meet a sad, bronze figure gazing down at you from his lofty plinth, the area permanently covered in flowers, candles and mementos. Senna isn't forgotten here. From 1976, a circuit we all know, Autodromo Internazionale del Mugello, in the Tuscan hills, was made a feature of our Grand Prix history. Built in 1973 and opened in 74, the area had a famous road circuit nearby since 1914, originally a dusty 66-kilometre track based around the Futa Pass, with villages like Scarperia and drivers like Materazzi immortalised by bends on the closed circuit. The first 500 GP in 1976 started under a cloud, with two Italian fatalities in the preceding 250 and 350 races. In fact, there were over 70 accidents that weekend on a circuit originally considered to favour only the cars. The 500cc race, though, was a thriller, with Sheen triumphing over his increasingly bitter rival Phil Reed, who was riding a privateer Suzuki in his final GP year. It was rumoured that the pair's rivalry was due to an alleged affair between Sheen and Reed's wife. Bazza? Surely not. To give you an idea how close the race was, both riders came away with the lap record, that being 2 minutes 7.6 seconds at just under 92 miles per hour. With no changes made to Mugello in the later 26 years other than resurfacing, Danny Pedrosa's lap record in 2012 of 1 minute 47.7 and 100 miles per hour is 20 seconds and 16 miles per hour faster than Bazza and the Prince of Speed. It clips Silverstone and is just behind Phillip Island, but in terms of drama, only the Ossi venue can compare. The rolling scenery and echoes of the Mille d'Emilia still inhabit the area, and this swooping circuit doesn't know what a flat piece of tarmac looks like. It also has a straight over a kilometre long, but it's not straight at all. And if you're ever lucky enough to be on the inside or paddock side of the track, you'll see the wheels lift and the whole bike shimmy at over 200 miles per hour as they hit the crest heading for Turn 1 or San Donato. In fact, the fastest crash in MotoGP history occurred here when the rear tyre of Shinya Nakano's Kawasaki exploded at close to the double ton. Thankfully, he survived. Of course, the Rossi fan club are here in force, and as you can bring your vehicles into the circuit, you see almost a week of partying and tomfoolery with abandoned custom-painted scooters and exploded engines on trestles that have been rived to destruction into the night. You wouldn't want the contract for cleaning this place up. Oh, and it rivals Imola for the most quintessentially Italian corner names. You ready? San Donato, Poggio Secco, Materazzi, Borgo San Lorenzo, Castanova, Savelli, Arrabbiata, Corentao, Piondete. You sort of get the idea. 1980, the fourth Italian circuit debuted. Virtually on the Adriatic coastline, the Misano circuit was built in 1967 between Rimini and Riccione, close to Italy's most popular seaside resort and homes to Benelli, Bimota, Morbidelli and some bloke called Rossi. Misano was initially quicker than Mugello, with Kenny Roberts beating Franco Uncini and Valet's dad Graziano with a lap of 152 kilometres or 94 miles per hour. Today it's over half a kilometre longer and the lap just breaks 100 miles an hour. That's if you're Jorge Lorenzo. There have been many changes and improvements to Misano to keep it in GP organisers' minds, as it was seen as lethal in the wet. In fact, in 1989, Lawson, Rainey, Schwantz, Mamola, Saron, and all the top riders decided after a cloudburst they would not race, and it was left to a tearful Frankie Kelly to score his and Pirelli's only blue ribbon victory, followed home by Simon Buckmaster. Frankie claimed sponsor pressure had led him to competing, and it was a miserable day. I know, I was there. Still, my mate had a claim to fame when Fred Merkel ran him off on one of the open-air karting tracks that ran around the venue late into the night. Misano lost their GP after Wayne Rainey's career ending crash in 1993, returning in 2007, having satisfying modern safety criteria and dramatically improving the runoff areas by reversing the track's direction to clockwise. Only in Italy. As Rossi's hometown of Tavuglia is just down the road, the atmosphere is carnival-like as the disciples march en masse from the town into the circuit, and the World Ducati weekend ensures Italian passions are always in evidence. A nice touch was incorporating the name of another local hero, Marco Simoncelli, into the circuit title. However, compared to Monza, Imola and Mugello, Misano could never lay claim to be the first, second or even third Temple of Speed. Still worth a visit though. If Italy has the passion and the excitement, then our next episode of Temples of Speed certainly has the history, heritage and downright danger as episode 4 visits Germany.
All right, so once again, a fantastic bit with Steve Brooks. We're going to keep bringing those to you as long as Steve seems willing to do it. And he is, based on the feedback that you sent to us and what he's read about the Temples of Speed series, I think he's going to keep going.
I hope so.
Yeah, and I'm not sure it's actually possible to run out of racetracks. You may have to end up wandering through some of the more obscure ones. But one of the things that he hasn't done so much so far, and I'm looking forward to because he said he'd like to, is to do some of the abandoned tracks, the tracks that are no longer in use, and the ghost tracks, if you will.
Yeah,
and those are the ones that for me are very haunting, and his tenor and mood and tone as he does these anyway, to me, is quite haunting anyway.
And it puts a shiver down your spine sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. Those of you that are listening to it and maybe haven't taken the opportunity to look up the history of some of these tracks, there are tons of resources online. I would highly suggest you take the opportunity to do so. If you can do it while he's talking about it, even cooler. I do promise that you will find yourself in the rabbit hole. And 3 hours later, you'll be going, oh my God, I just spent 3 hours looking at racetrack history. Yeah. And you know what? Trust me, you'll be the better for it. So take the opportunity.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I'd say take the opportunity to learn the history of your sport and the history of what racing has provided us, not only with the modern era, but with what has happened to the racing world over the years. It's absolutely guaranteed fascinating stuff. Just go take your site. Wikipedia is a pretty good resource, and follow the links at the bottom of the track pages, and you will find some amazing outstanding stuff that will just capture and captivate you. So I highly suggest you take a walk through the history of these circuits. It's amazing stuff.
And for anyone who, I know obviously some of you guys kind of during off season, you come back into awareness and to interest as the season gets closer. So if anyone listens to this week's episode of Steve's Temple of Speed, which is Italy and primarily Monza, I can't, and you like it, I can't recommend enough. If you haven't heard it, go back, and I will try and dig out and put in the show notes which episode it was. It was after we were discussing World Superbike Monza last year, which was an absolute debacle because of the amount of rain that was falling.
Yep.
And Jules was kind of, well, I don't like that track because it's really dangerous, and that, you know, yes, I know it's got the history. And it was almost as a rebuttal to Jules that Steve wrote in, And I cannot recommend enough talking about haunting and atmosphere creation. That very first one Steve sent, when he talks about you walk through this forest with leaves crunching under your feet, and then suddenly in this city edge parkland, you hear this screaming engine and there's a racetrack there. And it's absolutely brilliant the way he builds the picture.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt. I almost wish I could transport him to Indy just to kind of get his take on that place, because that place is steeped in history. And there are a lot of people that think of, it's unfortunate that I've only seen the Indy circuit on TV and have not been there. And if you go there, your opinion of the place will absolutely change. You may not be a super fan of the track itself, maybe the layout, but you walk in there and you realize that you've walked into someplace special. So the way that Steve does his take on things is great. Anyway, I could go on and on, and I often do. All right, Martin. We have, I believe at this point, well over 100 people in the Motopod Listeners League through MCN. So I'm Absolutely. Pretty stoked about that, since we only launched it, about 9 days ago, something like that. Very cool. If you'd like to join the league, we will have a link in the show notes, and we'd love to have you join us. Some of the team names just crack me up. There are some great ones in there. I'm currently fourth, which I'm quite pleased about.
The pin number, ladies and gents, I believe is 7247.
7247, indeed.
Maybe if you go to motorcyclenews.com, and then there are drop down links, or you can go motorcyclenews.com/FRR for Fantasy Road Race and follow the links, register. It's all free. And this year it's a CBR 500R, which is a bike that's passed me by. This is like a sporty mini CBR 6, I guess.
But it's a twin. It's the same one that they're going to be racing in the European Junior Cup alongside the World Superbike boys when they're racing on the Europe.
Oh, and of course, that's one thing we didn't mention. If anyone hasn't seen, just go on Google Images or go on to worldsuperbike.com and look at the photos. It's weird. They've all got the World Superbike bikes have all got these stickers on now to make them headlight stickers. They haven't got headlights, obviously, but they've got stickers on to make them look more like the road bikes. And it's just, it's like you're expecting them to indicate as they overtake each other.
Actually, the horns are going to be on next year, according to the rules. They started doing that last year, near the end of last year. If you remember that, I think the first team to do that was actually Sykes's team. And I remember seeing it in the last few races.
Did they race with them on? I thought they just had them for a couple of press photos.
Nope. I believe they actually. Right. Yep. There are a lot of people that think they're stupid. And that's just the only way you can put it. I think it's actually a interesting delineator between the, here's what it does in my mind. It provides people that watch World Superbike racing and that are, riders, track day riders, whatever, the chance to kind of look at a superbike, and go, oh, that's like my road bike. Whereas we know that in MotoGP land, for the most part, you're never going to have one of those. Or if you do, it's going to be, good Lord, I hope they don't decide to put headlight stickers on the CRTs. That would just be bad.
Panniers and stuff, luggage racks.
Okay, we shouldn't wander down that path. I don't want to denigrate the CRTs too much, because frankly, there are times. Okay, and here's something I should point out: when we looked at the test from Sepang, the CRT times are, if you look at the test from Sepang last year, Martin, they've closed down quite a bit, and I think that will continue to occur. And I look forward to it. Obviously, next year is going to be a big change with the rule changes that we have coming down. And as the year goes on, we will talk about those in depth as they change, because we know they will. Yeah. But in the meantime, my voice is about to leave me, Martin. So I think what I should do is leave you as well and leave the fans out there and say thanks so much for listening. Is there anything I'm missing?
Yeah, just the on the Motorcycle News Fantasy Road Race, guys, the entries, you can join afterwards, but if you don't get your team in registered by midnight British GMT this Friday, then you will have missed the boat. So you can watch first practice of Phillip Island, but don't leave it beyond, I think it's midnight Friday, because your entry won't count for this weekend, so you'll be starting off behind. Once you've registered your team, you can join our league at any time through the season. There's no penalty for that. But get your teams in there. It's totally free. They don't spam you with all sorts of rubbish, particularly if you tick the little boxes saying, don't spam me with all sorts of rubbish. Last year we had over 200 people in our league. It was fantastic fun. It's a source of banter during the season. And you get to humiliate us because we're not very good.
I think we had, at our highest count, 265 people in the league.
It was
epic. And I would not be surprised if we didn't exceed that this year, because they continued to join us as the year went on. I will warn you, if you try and join the league late in the year and you have a point total that is higher than me, I may think about it a bit.
Yeah.
Just a thought, because I am the administrator for this. I have to.
You had a pretty good year last year.
I did, but it was shit up until the last two setups.
I did my usual thing of picking riders and immediately jinxing them as they fell off and injured themselves.
Yeah. Well, I think we all do that. I think I made the best decision I made last year at one point was to not change my entries for two of the rounds. And I kind of got lucky because I have a tendency to make dozens of changes before I actually settle on something. So, All right, Martin, let's let these poor people go away and do something far more productive than listen to us prattle on.
Absolutely.
Guys, thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week with a plethora and a bounty of interviews from Phil Hall. And I have a few interview things that I am planning on putting together as well. Although I keep saying that they're not working out so well. We'll see how that goes. But in the meantime, I certainly look forward to some real racing this weekend, Martin, as I'm sure you do.
Absolutely. The season starts here.
The season starts here. Thanks, guys, and we'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, everyone. Good night.
Bye.